This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava.
And I'm Kathleen Harris.
And welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income on the Financial Sense News Hour. You know, recently I talked with Craig Johnson at Piper Jaffray about the market's possible action this year. Originally, Craig was talking about a hop, a drop, and then a pop. Well, we got the correction in so far, even though we're going up on the day we're doing this broadcast, which is Friday, a nice upward move in the stock price. Craig had changed his original forecast to a flop, drop, and a pop. Well, it looks like we're back to the pop again because the stock market is building up momentum. But I can tell you, I know it's making many of you very nervous. Anytime the stock market pulls back, and we saw that 4 or 5 times last year, and it's not unusual, 4 or 5% movements on the downside. I mean, every time we had a crisis last year, whether it was the fiscal cliff that we had, then we went into the sequester and we had a pullback. Then we went into the taper, we had a pullback. Then we came back from summer vacation and we had all kinds of worries. Syria, who was the next Fed chairman? The debt ceiling, and we had another drop. And then, of course, you know what we had. One of the best years in the stock market's history. So we continue to get a lot of requests from investors. You know, should I get out of stocks? Last week, we did a case about a couple that we put together a plan where we had a balance. We had some laddered bonds in the portfolio. We had some blue chip stocks. We had a little bit of gold. And the plan worked. When the market was correcting, as it was in the beginning of the year, bonds were doing very well. And there is this tendency always in this kind of market, because let's face it, folks, we're dealing in a market that is much, much different than, let's say, the 80s and 90s, where you could almost put your portfolio on cruise control. In the 80s, you just bought bonds. You were getting double digits. What did you need to do? If you were at the bank, heck, they gave you 12% on a CD and probably a free toaster. There wasn't much to do. And of course, the 90s, well, it was the stock market as Greenspan and the technological revolution that we were going through at that time. Stocks were going up double digits a year. People stopped saving. And it was like we were moving into this new prosperity. Well, things changed at the beginning of the decade. We got a bear market that took the S&P down over 40%. We went back up again, and then we got a financial crisis, or what we call the Great Recession, where we saw things we had never seen before. We saw interest rates get down to zero. We saw the Fed literally print trillions of dollars. In fact, their balance sheet is over $4 trillion. And we also saw trillion-dollar deficits. Well, the good news is the trade deficit has come down substantially, as the budget deficit has. Economic growth, well, it's not what it used to be. And it's not going to be what it used to be because there was too much debt accumulated in the last decade. But should you pull back or get out or jump out anytime we get a correction? And as we've talked on the weekend program in a Fed rate raising cycle, whenever they're in phase four, which is easy monetary policy, or they're easing, or in phase one, we're still in the easy monetary policy, but they're beginning to pull back a little bit as they are with taper, it's a good time to be invested in stocks. Where you don't want to be invested in the market, or trim back your position, or maybe get more defensive with type of stocks that you own, is when monetary policy becomes aggressive, they're tightening, and it becomes restrictive. We're not even close to that. So should you be moving out and reacting to your emotions, that is something that is very, very dangerous to do, and especially if you're in retirement. Think of the people that jumped out of the stock market in March of 2009, or the people that put $1.5 trillion into bond funds over the last 6 years when the market is up almost 200%. So do not let your emotions get the upper hand. Now, last week, Kath and I addressed a couple who came to us with a specific solution to their investment and income situation, but got distracted by what happens in the market after we allocated the portfolio. And folks, it's very easy to do that. I mean, look at it this way. If you're watching the financial news, how are they going to keep your attention if they're not either scaring you when the market's going down or getting you excited when the market's going up? So the market and the media are always playing to those two human emotions, fear and greed. And that's something you don't want to do.
Well, I think the problem with a fear and greed scenario, Jim, is that if you buy into it, it makes you start to have some really fuzzy investment thinking. You start to make decisions that maybe aren't based on the best, facts or the best information. You know, Sam and Melanie Krauss, we had put them in, as we mentioned earlier, we put them in some bonds and some stock and a little bit of gold. And they got, you know, really excited when the market kept going up and up and up throughout 2013. And they wanted us to move them all into stocks at the end of 2013. And we said, you know, you need to really stick to the plan at this point, which worked out well for them when the market was correcting earlier this month. But we've also had the opposite happen, Jim, where people have come to us and said, you know, I want completely out. And we understand that. It's been pretty scary for folks. The challenge is that once you're out, what do you do next? What's the challenge next? So this whole idea of having an allocation plan is something that you and I talk about a lot, Jim. And I think it's especially important to be very deliberate with your allocation plan when you're in retirement. And we've talked in various different case studies that we've done, Jim, about putting people in certain types of annuities and certain types of bonds and stock portfolios, etc. And we're very specific about the way we allocate people's funds for their retirement income situation. So I just want to say that you'll be talking with Dr. Wade Fow later on in the program about some new ways of looking at allocating funds in retirement. You know, a lot of people are invested in these target date retirement funds that sort of automatically rebalance you more towards bonds as you approach your retirement date. And I know that you and Dr. Fow had a really interesting discussion about maybe decreasing your equity portfolio and increasing your bond portfolio really isn't the best way to plan for retirement. So I'm looking forward to hearing what the two of you have to say coming up later on the program today.
It is going to be interesting because we're going to be talking about a lot of research that is done on studies on retirement. In other words, where should you put your money? And there have been a lot of programs over the years that they have these pie charts, these cookie cutter approaches, one that you'll see widely accepted in the financial planning industry is that, you know, the older you get, let's say you retire at age 60, you should have 60% of your portfolio in fixed income. And if you're 65, 65%. Well, what Wade Fow is going to be talking with me about, and there's been not just himself, but others that have researched this, everything you thought about retirement planning is the opposite of what it's going to be. In fact, his paper is called Reducing Retirement Risk with a Rising Equity Glide Path. In other words, the older you get, your equity portfolio should be a larger portion of that overall portfolio.
Jim, I just got to insert here that rising equity glide path, it's kind of a fancy schmancy term. What does that really mean, rising equity glide path?
It means that as you get older, instead of reducing your equity exposure, which has been the standard mantra practice for decades in the financial planning industry and on Wall Street, it's just the opposite. As you get older, in fact, the lowest percentage of your portfolio in equities should be the day you retire. You've got this big lump sum payment, but over the years, you should see that percentage increase because, Kathleen, we all know, I don't care if you're spending $3,000 a month, $4,000 a month, $5,000 a month. What is going to happen over time, and I think anybody listening to this program will attest to this fact, your cost of living is going to go up. Well, if you're increasingly putting more and more of your portfolio in fixed income that does not go up with cost of living, what are you going to do when you're facing rising medical costs? As we see now, the government is increasing the portion of Medicare that people have to pay. How are you going to take care of those needs, and especially in your latter years when medical expenses are getting more expensive? And you're more likely to run into more medical expenses, whether it's one spouse that becomes incapacitated through dementia or Alzheimer's, ends up in a retirement home. So almost the opposite of what you're thinking. And I really want you to listen to this interview because it's going to turn retirement planning upside down. But if you really think about it logically, it makes so much sense. So it's almost counterintuitive. You're thinking less stocks near the beginning of the retirement and gradually increase stocks during retirement. I bet you if you're talking to a financial advisor, they would never tell you that. It's the exact opposite of what we see practiced. The percentage in bonds equals your age. The allocation strategy for the most target date retirement funds is a good example. It may start out with maybe 20, 40% stocks at the beginning of retirement, or 60%, depending on what the age factor is. But gradually, those target funds reduce the allocation to stocks and increase the allocation to bonds. Well, Wade Fow's research and others have shown it should be exactly the opposite.
Well, I think what's really important to remember here, Jim, is that these are generalized concepts that are important to keep in mind when you're allocating your portfolio, but that when you're making a plan for your own specific income situation, you need to really be sure that you're doing an allocation that's appropriate for your situation. You and I have talked many times about how your bond investment should really be providing you with your core critical income if you have a shortfall in your pension and Social Security, and that stocks can be used to produce dividends that produce enough income to cover your discretionary spending, maybe act as a hedge on inflation and provide an opportunity for growth. You know, what this can mean, Jim, is that in these allocations we've been talking about where the bonds meet your critical spending and the stocks and their dividends meet your discretionary spending, it would seem to make sense that over time, your stock portfolio would naturally start to grow larger and sort of by itself start doing this whole quote-unquote rising equity glide path. In other words, increase the equity exposure just through its sheer growth in comparison to the bonds producing your predictable income.
Something that I want to emphasize, sometimes, you know, it's kind of like going to the doctor, Kathleen. A lot of times people have some medical issues that may be helped with things like diet and exercise or maybe reducing stress. But in our modern society of fast-paced living that we live in now, we're looking for the easy fix. You know, doc, I don't feel like exercising. I don't want to change my diet. You know, I don't want to change what I'm doing. Give me a pill. And that's what a lot of these target retirement date funds are. They're sort of like thinkless investments. Okay, at a certain age, at 65, I get this kind of target rate fund. At this age, I change it to one. And what it is really, it's putting your portfolio on autopilot. Now, that could be good or bad. It could be good in the sense that if you are a person that makes decisions on an emotional basis, having something disciplined or having that done for you is actually a good thing. However, given the macro environment, given inflation, given the way we're living with financial repression with low interest rates, that's a bad thing. And so you don't want to count for every single risk that's out there, but you don't want to be so inflexible. And a lot of these target funds, that's exactly what they are. They don't account for all the risks that exist out there. They're not flexible. They're static. They usually allocate more to bonds and cash as a retirement approaches and assume a cash out or purchase of annuity. And they also don't take into effect the longevity risk that we're running into now. So they tend to be overly conservative and not take into account things like inflation and the other things that we've seen take place. I mean, just take a look at what we've experienced over the last 5 or 6 years. Did you ever think 5 or 6 years ago you'd be looking at 2-year treasury notes that were paying 5% are now paying 0.3%? So the world changes, and that's a problem when you put everything on an automatic pilot, as many of these target funds do. Some target funds can, depending on which company you're dealing with, maintain a higher stock exposure after retirement date. Now, there is going to be some volatility, but it may help sustain spending throughout retirement. So you really need to know when you're getting into these things, just don't take a look at the date. Really understand what's going on in the portfolio and also understand your own personal financial needs in terms of, you know, is there a tendency in your family to have some kind of medical risk? Is there a history of medical risk in your family, dementia, Alzheimer's, or various diseases? Do you have enough sufficient funds right now if you're just barely skirting by right now with what you have, putting everything in fixed income? What are you going to do 5-10 years from now when inflation rates go up? So read the fine print, the target allocation path prior to retirement and after retirement. Really understand fully what you guys are doing and investing in so you don't put this on automatic pilot. The only time that I could really advocate doing something on an automatic pilot is if you tend to be an emotional person where you make your decisions more in emotion. When the stock market's going up, you feel like investing in stocks. When it's going down, you feel like selling, going to cash, and going to everything. And we've seen this mistake made over and over where emotions rule how individuals make their decisions.
I think you're making a really great point here, Jim, about when to go on autopilot and when not. And I think part of it's just knowing yourself as an investor, but also understanding the type of investment you place yourself in. Like we mentioned, some of these target date retirement funds are geared more to increase your bond and cash exposure the closer you get to your retirement date. Others, you know, not so much. And, you know, really, Jim, the reason why we're even talking about this today is I had a conversation recently with a young investor. Let's just call him Steven. who came in to talk with us about managing some assets. And while he was in a meeting with me, he shared with me his frustration with his parents' retirement planning. His parents had been working for a company that got bought out by a bigger company several years ago, and their retirement 401k funds were basically automatically rolled into these target date retirement funds. And it just so happened that their funds got rolled into a target date 2012 retirement fund. So he had been sort of after his parents for several years to really start thinking proactively about their retirement planning and their retirement saving. And like a lot of us kids, he didn't really have a lot of street cred with his parents when it came to talking about money. So they kind of said, oh yeah, sure. And they just kind of pushed the conversation aside. Well, finally, he convinced his parents to sit down and really look at their retirement planning and their retirement savings that they were setting aside at work. And their target date retirement fund, 2012, not surprisingly, had done absolutely nothing the last 2 years. Why? Because as 2012 approached, this target date fund was set up to move more and more to cash the closer that the retirement date came. So by the time 2012 rolled around, their portfolio was essentially 100% in cash in this target date retirement fund, completely missed out on 2 years of upturns in the market. So, you know, again, this kind of goes back to the idea of, you know what you're investing in. And we're not trying to say that all target date retirement funds are bad. We're just saying, know what you're getting into and whether or not the way that the retirement fund is going to rebalance your portfolio automatically prior to retirement and after the target date retirement, what that's going to look like, how it's going to feel, to see if it really makes sense for you and your spending that's going to have to take place in retirement.
Now, I want to revisit the couple that we talked about last week, Sam and Melanie Krause. And remember, their spending was about $80,000 a year. $60,000 was basic necessities. The other $20,000 was travel. They had Social Security, Sam's military pension of $52,000. The shortfall was $18,000 a year. Now, our allocation plan was roughly about $300,000 in a laddered bond portfolio at 3.5%. That produced about $10,500 in income and $500,000 in dividend-paying stocks at 3% with a dividend yield of $15,000. Now, here's the thing. As interest rates rise with the laddered bond portfolio, as those bonds come due, there's going to be less in bonds, and we're still going to come up with the amount of dependable income required. Because what do dividend stocks do? They increase those dividends over time. So as a person's needs increase with inflation, medical expenses, travel expenses, whatever it is that you're spending money on, you've got a source of increasing income to take care of those needs. And this will go back to something that we're going to be talking about here in a moment when I interview Dr. Wade Pfau, who is also a CFA, and his studies. He is also the professor of retirement planning at the American College and has spent a lifetime studying retirement investment allocations. So more or less, as you take a look at this and you start thinking about retirement, I know sometimes when you see the stock market go down 5%, you look at the media is scaring the heck out of you, and then you got, you know, the dooms guys out there that are always saying the sky is falling, the sky is falling, which has been the same mantra repeated over the last 5 or 6 years. And think of the bad advice that they've given, telling people to get out of the dollar is strengthened, telling people to get out of the U.S., where if you've been listening to the Premium Channel, as many of my guests, very well-known, very astute people from Barron's Roundtable members have said, even recently Felix Zuloff, who I just interviewed, a member of the Barron's Roundtable, said the U.S. has got the best-looking house in a global neighborhood. So you got to start thinking differently and make whatever you do in your retirement plan fit you personally. And also, one thing please try to avoid is making decisions on an emotional basis. It's probably the worst thing that you can do personally, and it will cause more harm in your portfolio and your retirement goals than anything else. So more or less what Dr. Pfau is asking us to consider when we approach retirement planning, spending, and investing is take a look at actually how it works out through our retirement years. And that's the one thing that we have pointed out here with case study after case study, and we've seen it in my 30 years in the planning business, is in the latter years, maybe you're not spending as much money on travel, but you're spending a heck of a lot more money on medical. And with the way government policy is going with Obamacare, that's going to increase even more. You're going to be shouldering more of that responsibility yourself. And you have to ask yourself, how are you going to take care of that? If everything you have is fixed or in cash earning nothing, How are you going to take care of those future expenses? We'll be talking about that in just a moment. For years now, in fact, actually for decades, there's been a standard procedure when you retire. Well, if you're 60 years old, 60% of your portfolio should go into bonds. And the older you get, that equity exposure should be reduced. But with low interest rates, rising cost of retirement, there are new questions. Does that really work anymore? Joining us on the program is Dr. Wade Fow. He's a professor of retirement income at the American College. Wade, let's talk about that. This concept about age and bonds. You're 60 years old, you retire, you should have 60% of your portfolio. If you're 65, you should have 65%. Does that really work?
Well, I think that can be somewhat reasonable pre-retirement, but when you actually get to your retirement date and start retirement, I don't think that works anymore, and has been shown with the historical data and also with a variety of ways that continuing to decrease your stock allocation after you retire definitely leads to worse outcomes for people.
There have been a number of studies, and in fact, one of the rules, I'm trying to think of the financial planner in California, was the 4% rule that you and I have talked about previously. For example, if you were expected to live, let's say, 25 years in retirement, and you had $100,000, if you drew 4% a year, it would work out perfectly. The last year of your life, you'd be down to your last amount of savings, and it would work perfect. Now people are really questioning that 4% rule. And part of that, we've talked about this in the past, where somebody may use annuities combined with equity, may work much better than a fixed income portfolio. So let's talk about, there have been a number of studies, and the results are suggesting that as a person gets older, instead of reducing the amount of equity, a rising equity glide path in retirement has the potential to reduce both the probability and the magnitude of failure for a portfolio.
Right. That's the idea, that essentially you want to have the lowest stock allocation when your portfolio is the largest. And in a typical lifetime, that's going to be right around the retirement date. So your lifetime equity glide path is more like a U-shape. It declines up into retirement and then increases afterwards. So initially that can sound scary. And the common thing people immediately say is, well, having a 90-year-old in 90% stocks. But that's not really the idea. That 4% rule, all of the financial planning research based on the sustainable withdrawal rates recommends pretty high stock allocations for retirees, 50 to 75% stocks. And what I was saying with Michael Kitsis in this article about the rising equity glide path, that that's fine as a place to end up, but initially at the start of retirement, you would have less stocks and then slowly work your way back towards that. And also we looked as well at income annuities. And one of the reasons that income annuities tend to make the retirement picture look better, just one of several reasons, is that they actually imply a rising equity glide path. Because as you go through your retirement and your time horizon gets shorter, the present value of the remaining payments coming from that income annuity are going to be declining. And more often than not, your stocks hopefully are maintaining their level. And so you'd actually have a rising equity glide path.
Let's talk about, there's a concept called Safe Max, the highest sustainable withdrawal rate. In the worst case scenario, it became smaller as the pace of the stock phase down increased, which has been sort of typical advice given to retirees. Oh, you're 65, you have this amount in equities. Oh, you're 70, well, you reduce your equity exposure. Let's talk about, because this phase down in stock allocation, really, it was kind of like for each year you get older, a 1% annual phase down in your stock allocation, that's not working.
Right. So the idea as well, it's basically if you have a long retirement at 25 or 30 years, you're really overly impacted by what happens in the first part of retirement. And part of the idea behind the 4% rule got at that. It's the idea of sequence of returns risk. Well, if you have terrible market returns for the entire 30 years of retirement, then this is a very terrible scenario that the rising glide path wouldn't help. But a more realistic kind of worst case scenario that people might face is they have those negative market returns in the early part of their retirement. And even with the 4% rule, we see that. The worst case scenario that defined the 4% rule was somebody retiring in 1966. And over a 30-year retirement, the first 15 or 16 years, 1966 through the early 1980s, was a pretty miserable market environment. And then after the early 80s to the mid-90s, there was a booming market environment. Yet, so even though the last half of their retirement saw good stock market conditions, it was really already too late for them because they had been digging themselves into a hole, spending their assets, spending down their principal. And even when the market subsequently recovered, they didn't have enough left in their portfolio to enjoy the recovery. And the rising equity glide path helps that kind of scenario, that you protect the portfolio by having the lower stock allocation early in retirement to protect yourself better from the sequence of returns risk. And then if you're not in a worst case scenario, because 4% was designed to really try to protect historically what was a worst case scenario, if you're not in that kind of environment, your portfolio is going to continue to grow. The percentage of your assets that you'll be withdrawing as you proceed through retirement may decline, and you're going to be in good shape no matter what happens at that point.
You know, the literature, there's a lot of it out there in terms of these asset allocation strategies in retirement, and there's three potential reasons to vary the asset allocation over retirement. I wonder if you could go over those three as you wrote in your article.
There's the age-based kind of thing that you already mentioned at the beginning, using something like your age in bonds, or you could have it linked to market valuation. So there's this idea of valuation-based asset allocation, where this has generally been based around Robert Shiller's cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio. If you look at that, that can help you guide your asset allocation. When the markets are overvalued, you adjust down your stock allocation. And then if markets are undervalued, you could increase your stock allocation. Jonathan Guyton has done some work in that area as well and has shown that that can help to reduce the volatility of a portfolio. And then as well, there's an idea of the funded ratio, of thinking about someone's future spending needs as liabilities that they have to fund with their assets, and then linking their assets to their liabilities and figuring out if they're just quite well funded so that they have just enough assets to cover their liabilities, then that's going to be the case where they would have the lowest stock allocation because they want to lock in their lifestyle spending by having less risky assets. But if they are overfunded and have additional assets well beyond what they need to cover their spending needs, then they could still think about locking in their spending needs with a lower amount of their assets, and then that would allow them to have a higher stock allocation with anything left over. And that sort of approach would be really the best recommendation for people to use, especially if they're working with financial advisors. The idea of the rising equity glide path, we meant that more in terms of what should be a default asset allocation glide path for people who are not otherwise interested in taking care of their investment matters.
There were a number of studies, and this gets to the maximum withdrawal rate. And what has been found is, for example, you may want to start out, as you talk about, with the maximum amount of assets when you retire. Let's say that's your portfolio. So maybe at that point, there's less allocation to stocks. But as you get older, that percentage starts to increase. So you might start out with 20, but at the end of your life, you end up with 40, or you might start out with 40 and end up with 80. Wade, this is almost just the opposite. I'm sure people listening to this program have been told either by their advisors or reading magazines or literature about retirement planning, but your studies show that this is much more effective.
Usually people have focused on the accumulation period, and the idea that all the life cycle target date funds use, that you have a declining glide path at stock allocation as you age, that there's two justifications for that. The first being the idea of human capital, that when people are young, most of their wealth is stored in their future earnings from their careers. They don't have much financial assets relative to their human capital, and so they can have a more aggressive allocation. And as well, just looking at people wanting to try to meet a wealth accumulation goal, it makes sense to have that declining glide path. But I think people just weren't really extending that into retirement. So your human capital will hit zero once you're retired. I mean, there may be some flexibility that you could return to work in a worst-case scenario, but I think this is a really secondary type consideration. Once you get to retirement, your human capital is quite low. It's not really changing that much anymore. So what do you do then with your asset allocation? I think people just hadn't really looked at it. It doesn't imply you would continue to have a decreasing stock allocation post-retirement. As we looked at the matter some more, it actually, because of that sequence of returns risk, you get the most downside protection by having a lower stock allocation at retirement and then just increasing it later on.
When you take a look at what has happened, I can think back, you know, when we had that stable period of time, Wade, in the 80s and 90s, stocks went up. We had high interest rates. Today, we're in a low interest rate environment, so withdrawal rates in bond portfolios don't work as well. I can remember back, gosh, in the 80s, all I did was bonds. I got 12, 13% on Ginny Mae's. I could get 8 or 9% on tax-free bonds. And even throughout the 90s and the early part of the last decade, we had higher interest rates. Now, since that period of time, we've had two major bear markets. So when you mention increasing stock allocation as you get older, to some people that may seem illogical.
I can understand, but the main issue with that is people immediately might think that 90-year-old 90% stocks. And that's not really the idea. We're basing this on the kind of work that the financial planners are doing related to systematic withdrawals. How can you spend down your portfolio? And again, they're saying 50 to 75% stocks over your whole retirement. And we're saying, well, that's okay at the end of retirement, but go less than that early in retirement. Traditional financial planning advice would have you be, say, 60% stocks your whole time. So even when you're 90 years old, we're saying we'll start off maybe with around 30% stocks, but then work your way back up to 60% stocks. I think it's just people immediately think of 90% stocks for 90-year-olds or 100% stocks for 100-year-olds. And it doesn't have to be so extreme. That's not really what we're saying with it. But I think it's the reaction people have when they hear about it the first time.
There's also something, too, Wade, that I think of, and this gets back to investors like Warren Buffett. You take a stock like Coca-Cola. It pays a dividend yield that's equal to a bond right now. But more importantly, every year, Coke has been increasing its dividend yield by 9-10% a year. Now, if you take somebody that's retired, having some blue chip stocks in the portfolio that increase income, that help you, let's say, cope with rising medical cost or the cost of retirement. But we also know one thing as well. If you invest in a stock that keeps increasing its dividend year after year after year, number one, it's probably a more stable company. It probably has an international franchise. But you can't keep increasing the dividends year after year without eventually the value of the stock going up, which means it could become a larger percentage of your portfolio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, until just the last early 2000s or mid-2000s, most portfolios would have been providing income of at least 4%, and that's not the case anymore. And yeah, as you're talking about building a portfolio with dividend-paying stocks, that can be part of an effective strategy. I think it's an area that's a bit under-researched because it's just hard to get the long historical data on a large number of stocks that have paid high dividends. But certainly, it's a way to think about building a retirement portfolio.
So when you get back to, let's say you take an individual. In your studies, you have found that one of the things that works very well and has been more effective, especially in this low interest rate environment that we find ourselves in today, is you take part of the portfolio, you annuitize it, you've got a larger cash flow stream coming in that's predictable. But then what you do to work in combination with that is a rising equity portfolio that provides not only growth in assets, but also growth in income.
Right. The idea is because if you do annuitize part of your portfolio, we're then talking about not just looking at your financial assets anymore, but thinking about your entire household balance sheet. And that's an important part of retirement, thinking about how to build a retirement income strategy. It's the entire household balance sheet. So that income annuity has a present value. Every year, as you receive income and your remaining lifetime is getting shorter, the present value of that remaining annuity payment will decline as you age. And so if your financial portfolio otherwise stayed at about the same level, for example, and you have whatever percent allocated to stocks, then when you're thinking holistically from your total household balance sheet, your stock allocation as a percent of your entire household assets would be increasing in that kind of case. That's the basic idea.
Do you think, Wade, that you're going to see a lot more work and studies done in this area and a lot more rethinking? I mean, obviously, we're living in a different environment today. I mean, the 80s and 90s, I mean, it was basically high interest rates. Stocks went up every year. Then you take a look at the last 13 years where, you know, here we are. We used to talk about Japan and zero interest rates. Well, here we are in the U.S. with zero interest rates. Bond yields aren't the same. They're not as high as they once were. It's very difficult to get a real return above the inflation rate today in bonds. And then also we have things like quantitative easing. We've got all these larger macro events that are influencing markets, that this is changing. And I think in that process of change, we're also going to be thinking differently about retirement.
I worry that too much of our rules of thumb related to retirement are based on the exceptional performance of the U.S. economy in the 20th century. That if you look around the world, and one of the first studies I did in this area was looking at, would the 4% rule have worked in other developed economies? And the answer was generally no, except for Canada. Canada and the U.S. were basically the only two out of now 20 developed market countries since 1900 where 4% would have been historically successful in every case. In a country like Italy, just a hypothetical Italian retiree using Italian stocks and Italian bonds, 4% would have only worked in about 20% of the historical cases, not 100% like in the U.S. So I do worry that too much of our rules of thumb related to retirement are based on the exceptional when the U.S. became the world's leading superpower. And this is not something pessimistic about the U.S., but just if the U.S. has a more normal experience in the 21st century, that some of the rules of thumb we use to guide retirement are not going to be workable. They're a lot riskier than people may think.
Everybody's different. Everybody has a different tolerance for risk. Everybody has different circumstances. I mean, some people are fortunate enough that they either worked for the government or they worked with a company that still had a defined benefit pension plan that was predictable. Others have had to go through various job changes where all they've got is what they put together in a 401k program that they roll over into an IRA. We have Social Security. And then we also have changing healthcare costs that are coming in now with the Obamacare. So there's a lot of moving dynamics that are moving into the retirement planning process that is going to make it, I think, a situation where there's a lot more customization. In other words, these old standard cookie cutter percentage things that were so prevalent for almost decades, I think are really antiquated at this point.
Right. So some of those rules, like the 4% rule or the idea that you'll want to replace 80% of your pre-retirement salary as spending when you retire and so forth, those kinds of things might be okay for somebody who's 25 or 35 years old and just thinking ahead about how much should they be saving for retirement. But there's too much variation. People have different circumstances. And yeah, there really aren't basic rules of thumb that can be applied to the retirement problem. Everyone's got a different situation.
So in terms of advice, what kind of advice would you give to somebody today that's retiring? You know, you're going to have to find a planner or if you're doing it yourself, but our industry itself is still stuck with a lot of those rules.
There's an increasing movement towards educating advisors more on the retirement income problem. Even something like the CFP designation, they need to really catch up to what's going on today. Their retirement planning education is based much more on pre-retirement, not how to build a retirement income strategy. So yeah, people just need to keep reading. And there's a lot of advisors who are getting educated. There's a few different retirement income designations that are helping to fill those gaps. And it's really only been, I think, in the last 10 years that there's this realization that retirement income planning is different from pre-retirement wealth accumulation. Traditional wealth management is just like, how can we maximize wealth or how can you maximize your risk-adjusted return to your portfolio? But the retirement income problem isn't how do I maximize my wealth? It's how can I sustain my lifestyle spending goals over an uncertain lifetime? So it's a very different problem and it requires different solutions. And there's now increasingly more recognition that that's the case.
Wade, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow a lot of the research that you're doing there at the American College, how can they do so, please?
I have a blog that I'm pretty active with. If they just Google the Retirement Researcher blog, they should be able to find me or Google my name. My last name is spelled P, F as in Frank, A-U. I'm lucky that I'm the only person on the internet with my name, so it's pretty easy to find me online.
Well, listen, Wade, I want to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. I think this is a topic that really needed to be brought up because the rules are changing and the times are changing, and we need to adjust to that. Wade, thanks for joining us on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that concludes my interview with Wade Pfau, but once again, a topic that I think is very important to address when it comes to retirement planning, because as all of us have seen over the last 13 years with two bear markets in stocks and also bear markets in gold and the falling value of real estate, something that we hadn't seen in half a century, a lot of people are having to rethink their retirement plans and the standard rules, the cookie cutter stuff that they give you with the pie charts. You know what? A lot of that stuff is no longer applicable. In fact, it's probably antiquated. That's why I think the planning process is going to be much more dynamic going forward. On behalf of Kathleen Harris and myself, Jim Poplava, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.